and to finish the game. The Russian did not seem surprised to see him. Perhaps he was expecting me? Thought Bromhead. Such an experienced and observant officer could well have noticed my car on one of the previous days. Once again, his friendly smile, then deadly serious application to the game. In fact, as he played on, and Bromhead observed from a spectator's bench, Gordievsky's mind was whirling. Everything was slotting into place. Kaplan's visit, the party at Bromhead's house, and the fact that the genial British official seemed to have been at every social event he had attended in the last 3 months. The KGB had identified Bromhead as a probable intelligence officer, with a reputation for extrovert behavior, and turning up at embassy parties whether he had been invited or not. The Englishman's appearance in the deserted badminton court at this hour in the morning could mean only one thing. MI6 was trying to recruit him. The game came to an end. Anna headed to the showers, and Gordievsky sauntered over, a towel around his neck, hand outstretched. The two intelligence officers assessed each other. Oleg displayed no sign of nervousness, Bromhead wrote. Gordievsky noted that the Englishman, who usually radiated ebullient self-confidence, seemed for once deadly serious. They spoke a combination of Russian, German, and Danish, into which Bromhead inserted some incongruous French. Would you be able to talk to me tête-à-tête? I would love to have a private conversation, some place where we would not be overheard. I would like that, said Gordievsky. It would be very interesting for me to have that sort of conversation with a member of your service. I think you are one of the few who would speak honestly to me. Another line crossed. Bromhead had revealed he knew Gordievsky was a KGB officer. Could we have lunch? Bromhead continued. Yes, of course. It might be more difficult for you to meet up than for me, so why don't you name a restaurant that would suit you? Bromhead had expected Gordievsky to choose some obscure, discreet rendezvous spot. Instead, he suggested they meet in 3 days' time at the restaurant in the Ustaport Hotel, directly across the main road from the Soviet embassy. As he drove away in his wife's battered car, Bromhead was elated, but also uneasy. Gordievsky had seemed strangely calm, apparently unperturbed by the approach. He had chosen a restaurant so near his own embassy that a hidden microphone would be able to relay their conversation to listeners across the road. They could be spotted by Soviet officials, who frequently dined at the hotel. For the first time, it struck Bromhead that he might be the target, not the initiator, of an attempted enlistment. Oleg's behavior and choice of restaurants made me strongly suspect I was being played at my own game. It was all just too easy. It didn't feel right. Back at the embassy, Bromhead fired off a cable to MI6 headquarters. For God's sake, I think he's trying to recruit me. But Gordievsky was merely establishing his cover. He, too, returned to his embassy and asked the resident, Mogilevchik, this fellow from the British embassy has invited me to lunch. What do I do? Should I accept? The question was passed on to Moscow, and an emphatic reply immediately boomed back from Dmitry Yakushin, the grey cardinal. Yes, you should be aggressive and not shy away from an intelligence officer. Why not meet him? Take an offensive position. Britain is a country of high interest to us. This was Gordievsky's insurance policy. Having obtained official permission to go ahead, he could now make sanctioned contact with MI6 without the KGB suspecting his loyalty. One of the oldest gambits in intelligence is the dangle, when one side appears to make a play for someone on the other, lures him into complicity, and gains his trust before exposing him. Bromhead wondered if he was the target of a KGB dangle. If not, was Gordievsky genuinely trying to recruit him? Should he pretend to be interested and see how far the Soviets were prepared to go? For Gordievsky, the stakes were even higher. The visit from Kaplan and Bromhead's subsequent approach might all be part of an elaborate plot, in which he revealed his hand only to be exposed. Yakushin's blessing provided some protection, but not much. If he fell victim to an MI6 dangle, his career in the KGB would be over. He would be recalled to Moscow. He would doubtless fall victim, retrospectively, to the KGB logic that anyone the other side attempted to recruit was, prima facie, suspect. James Jesus Angleton, the famously paranoid post-war chief of counterintelligence at the CIA, described the spying game as a wilderness of mirrors. Already, the Gordievsky case was reflecting and refracting in strange ways. Bromhead was still pretending to arrange a casual meeting between fellow intelligence officers, albeit on different sides of the Cold War, while wondering if he was being recruited himself. Gordievsky was pretending to his KGB bosses that this was a stab in the dark by British intelligence, a chance encounter leading to lunch, while wondering if MI6 might be planning to stitch him up. 3 days later, Bromhead walked through the cemetery behind the embassies, crossed the busy Dag Hammarskjöld's alley, entered the Österport Hotel, and took a seat in the restaurant with his back to the window, where he could keep a close watch on the main entrance to the dining room. Pett had been informed the lunch was taking place, but Bromhead had insisted there should be no surveillance present, in case Gordievsky spotted it and backed out. I carefully examined all the other people in the restaurant to see if I could recognize any other member of the Soviet embassy staff, whose pictures were all filed in our office. Everyone seemed to be an innocent Dane, or an equally innocent tourist. I sat back, wondering if Oleg would come. Gordievsky entered the dining room exactly on time. Bromhead detected no hint of special nervousness, though his style was intrinsically taut, poised for action. He saw me at once. Had he already been told which table I had reserved? I wondered, as my mind raced into conventional spy fever. Oleg smiled his usual friendly smile and walked over. Bromhead felt a friendly atmosphere from the start as they tucked into the Österport's excellent Scandinavian buffet. The conversation ranged across religion, philosophy, and music. Oleg made a mental note that his companion had done his homework and took trouble to talk about subjects of interest to me. When Bromhead remarked how odd it was that the KGB deployed so many officers abroad, Gordievsky's response was non-committal. The Russian mostly spoke Danish. Bromhead replied in a messy mixture of Danish, German, and Russian, a linguistic smorgasbord that made Gordievsky laugh, though there didn't seem to be any malice in his amusement. He seemed to be totally relaxed, and was obviously aware that we were both intelligence officers. When coffee and schnapps had been served, Bromhead asked the crucial question. Will you have to file a report about our meeting? The reply was revealing. Probably, yes, but I'll make it a very neutral one. Here, finally, was the hint of collusion. Not a flash of leg, exactly, but the glimpse of an ankle. Even so, Bromhead left the lunch more puzzled than ever. Gordievsky had hinted that he was, in part, concealing the truth from the KGB. But he was also behaving exactly like a man who believed he was the hunter, not the prey. Bromhead sent a memo to MI6 headquarters. I emphasized my fear that it had been much too easy, and the strong impression I had that he was being so nice to me because he wanted to recruit me. Gordievsky also reported back to his bosses, a long, insipid document, concluding that the meeting had been of interest, but framed to emphasize the apparent importance of my own initiative. The Grey Cardinal was delighted. And then something quite extraordinary happened. Nothing at all. The Gordievsky case went dead. For 8 months, there was no contact whatever. Quite why this happened remains a mystery. In Geoffrey Guscott's words, looking back, you think, how dreadful. The case just went into the long grass for months. We were waiting for the Danes to report, waiting for Bromhead to come back. But nothing happened. Bromhead took his eye off it. He was pursuing two or three others, and it was such a long shot. You think it is never going to happen. Perhaps Bromhead's suspicions had applied the brakes harder than he intended. If you push too hard too quickly, it can go wrong, said Guscott. When it goes right, it is often because you don't push. In this case, MI6 failed to push at all. It was a cock-up. But it was a cock-up that, in the long run, worked. Gordievsky was concerned when weeks passed without an effort by Bromhead to renew contact, then dismayed, then quite angry, and finally oddly reassured. The pause gave him time for reflection. If this had been a dangle, MI6 would have moved much faster. He would wait, give the KGB time to forget the contact with Bromhead. In spying, as in love, a little distance, a little uncertainty, an apparent cooling on one side or the other can stimulate desire. In the 8 frustrating months that followed lunch at the Oosterpoort Hotel, Gordievsky's enthusiasm grew. On October 1st, 1974, the tall Englishman reappeared at the badminton court in the dawn light and suggested they meet again. Bromhead's reason for suddenly re-establishing contact was that he was being redeployed to Northern Ireland as an undercover officer to conduct operations against the IRA. He would be leaving in a few months. There was not much time left. I had decided, therefore, to waste no more of it, Bromhead later wrote, with a briskness that suggests he was fully aware he had been wasting time. They agreed to meet at the SAS Hotel, run by Scandinavian Airlines, a brand new building never frequented by Soviet officers. Bromhead was waiting at a corner table in the bar area when Oleg arrived. Asterix and Obelix, the two pet agents, had arrived sometime earlier and were sitting at the opposite end of the bar, trying to look inconspicuous behind a potted palm tree. With his usual clockwork punctuality, Oleg walked through the door on the stroke of 1 o'clock. The light was dim in the corner I had chosen, and for a moment Oleg looked around. To prevent him taking too much notice of the surveillance, I rose quickly to my feet. He came straight over with his familiar smile. The atmosphere was immediately different. I felt it was time I took the initiative, Gordievsky later recalled. I was alive with anticipation. He had sensed this, and felt the same. Bromhead moved first. MI6 had authorized him to indicate that this was more than a flirtation. After our drinks had been brought, I went straight to the point. You're KGB. We know you have worked in Line N of the First Chief Directorate, the most secret of all your departments, which is running illegals all over the world. Gordievsky did not hide his surprise. Would you be prepared to talk to us about what you know? Gordievsky gave no reply. Bromhead pressed on. Tell me, who is the PR line deputy in your section? The person in charge of political intelligence gathering and agent running? There was a pause, and then the Russian broke into a broad grin. I am. Now it was Bromhead's turn to be impressed. I had toyed with the idea of talking about world peace and so on, but my intuition about Oleg told me not to try any such blarney. But everything was still too easy. My suspicious mind was unable to accept this man at face value. My instinct was telling me that he was a remarkably nice person and I could trust him. My training and experience of KGB officers, on the other hand, was screaming caution. Another marker had been put down, and both knew it. All at once we were almost colleagues, wrote Gordievsky. At last we began to speak in plain language. Bromhead now administered the acid test. Would you be prepared to meet me in private, in a safe place? The Russian nodded. Then he said something that flicked an invisible light from amber to green. No one is aware that I am meeting you. After their first encounter, Oleg had informed his superiors and written up a report. This meeting was unsanctioned. If the KGB discovered he had contacted Bromhead and kept it secret, he was doomed. By informing MI6 that he had told no one, he was making his switch of allegiance perfectly clear and putting his life in their hands. He had crossed over. This was a big step, Gascott later recalled. It was the equivalent in adultery of saying, "My wife doesn't know I'm here." Gordievsky felt a flood of relief and a fluttering surge of adrenaline. They agreed to meet again in 3 weeks in a bar on the edge of the city. Gordievsky departed first, Bromhead a few minutes later. Finally, the two Danish undercover intelligence officers emerged from behind a potted plant. The courtship was over. Major Gordievsky of the KGB was now working with MI6. Sunbeam was up and running. In that one cathartic moment, in the corner of a Copenhagen hotel, all the strands of a long-brewing rebellion had come together. his anger at his father's unacknowledged crimes, his absorption of his mother's quiet resistance and his grandmother's hidden religious beliefs, his detestation of the system he had grown up in and his love of the Western freedoms he had discovered, his simmering outrage over the Soviet repressions of Hungary and Czechoslovakia and the Berlin Wall, his sense of his own dramatic destiny, cultural superiority, and optimistic faith in a better Russia. From now on, Oleg Gordievsky would live two distinct and parallel lives, both secret and at war with each other. And the moment of commitment came with the special force that was central to his character, an adamantine, unshakable conviction that what he was doing was unequivocally right, a whole-souled moral duty that would change his life irrevocably, a righteous betrayal. When Bromhead's report landed in London, the senior officers of MI6 were gathered for a conference at the service's secret training base in Fort Monckton, a Napoleonic-era fortress near Portsmouth on England's south coast. At 10 p.m, a small group gathered to consider Bromhead's report and decide on a course of action. "The question of whether this was a provocation was raised time and again," said Geoffrey Guscott. "Would a senior KGB officer really be willing to risk his life by meeting secretly with a known MI6 operative? On the other hand, would the KGB dare to dangle one of its own officers?" After a tense debate, it was agreed to press ahead. Sunbeam might seem too good to be true, but it was also too good to pass up. 3 weeks later, Bromhead and Gordievsky met in the dark, almost empty bar. Both had carefully dry-cleaned themselves en route. Both were black. Their conversation was businesslike, but halting. The lack of a common language was a serious impediment. The English and Russian spies had established an understanding. They just couldn't fully understand what was being said. Bromhead explained that since he would soon be leaving Copenhagen, responsibility for handling future meetings would be transferred to a colleague, a senior intelligence officer who spoke fluent German and could therefore converse with Gordievsky more easily. Bromhead would select a convenient safe house in which to meet, make the introductions, and then bow out of the case. The secretary of the Copenhagen MI6 station lived in a flat in the residential suburb of Charlottenlund. The place was easy to reach by subway, and the secretary would make herself scarce at the appropriate time. Bromhead suggested he meet Gordievsky in the doorway of a butcher's shop near the flat at 7 p.m. in 3 weeks' time. The doorway provided a convenient shadow from the bright streetlights. Also, it was difficult to post any watcher near that doorway without their being clearly visible in the surroundings. By that time of day, the place would be deserted, and all the Danes would be cozy and tucked up with their TVs. Gordievsky arrived at 7 on the dot. Bromhead appeared moments later. After a silent grasping of hands, the Englishman said, "Come, I'll show you the way." The safe flat, or OCP in spy jargon, standing for Operational Clandestine Premises, was barely 200 yards away. But Bromhead took a circuitous route, in case anyone was following. "The night was cold, with drifting snowflakes," recalled Bromhead. Both men were bundled up inside overcoats. Gordievsky was silent, plunged in thought. "I was not afraid of being kidnapped, but I knew that things were now serious. This was the real start of operations. For the first time I was entering enemy territory." Bromhead unlocked the door of the flat, ushered Gordievsky in, and poured them both stiff whiskies and soda. "How long have you got?" asked Bromhead. "About half an hour." "I'm quite surprised you turned up. Are you not running a grave risk, seeing me like this?" Gordievsky paused and, in a very measured way, replied, "It might be dangerous, but at this moment I do not think it will prove to be so." Bromhead carefully explained, in his odd jumble of languages, that he would be flying back to London the next morning, and then on to Belfast. But he would return in 3 weeks, meet Gordievsky in the butcher's doorway, bring him here to the flat, and introduce his new case officer. A small group of pet officers knew what was happening, but the case would be run exclusively by MI6. For Gordievsky's safety, Bromhead assured him, only a tiny handful of people inside British intelligence would ever know he existed, and most of these would never learn his real name. In intelligence language, Someone made party to a secret operation is indoctrinated. The case would involve the smallest number of indoctrinees possible, and would be run under the tightest security since there might be Soviet spies within PET or MI6, ready to report back to Moscow. Even the CIA, the intelligence service of Britain's closest ally, would be kept out of the loop. With these factors in our favor, we could put our relationship on sound foundations and begin serious cooperation. As he bid Gordievsky farewell, Bromhead reflected how little he really knew about the smiling, apparently nerveless, Russian KGB officer who seemed ready to risk his life by colluding with MI6. The question of money had never arisen, nor had Oleg's own safety, or that of his family, or whether he wished to defect. They had talked generally about culture and music, but not about politics, ideology, or life under Soviet rule. Gordievsky's motivation had not been discussed. I never asked him why he was doing it. There just wasn't time. Those questions were still niggling Bromhead when he arrived the next morning in MI6's London headquarters. The controller of the Sov Block division was reassuring. He was very experienced in KGB matters and suitably cautious, but said this was a unique situation, which had to be exploited to the full. It was the first time any KGB officer had responded positively to a British approach from cold. The Soviets were far too paranoid, he said, to dangle someone with access to real secrets. They had never offered up a serving KGB staff officer. They just didn't trust their own not to go off in a relationship with a Western case officer. The MI6 bosses were optimistic. Sunbeam could prove to be a breakthrough case. Gordievsky seemed genuine. Bromhead was not so sure. The Russian spy had yet to produce a single shred of useful intelligence, let alone an explanation for what he was doing. Transferring an agent from one case officer to another is a complex and sometimes fraught process, particularly when the spy is newly recruited. In January 1975, 3 weeks after leaving Copenhagen, Bromhead was infiltrated as quietly and anonymously as possible back into Denmark. He flew to Gothenburg in Sweden, where he was met by the PET officer, Winter Clausen. Squeezed into the passenger seat of a Volkswagen alongside Obelix's vast and grinning bulk, he crossed the border into Denmark and checked into a suitably impersonal and suburban hotel in Copenhagen's Lyngby shopping district. Philip Hawkins, the new handler, flew in from London on a false passport. "You will like him," Bromhead had told Gordievsky. He was not entirely sure this was true. "I certainly didn't like him. I thought he was a prize shit." This was neither accurate nor fair. Hawkins was a barrister by training, severe, precise, and not a bit like Bromhead. After meeting Gordievsky at the butcher shop, Bromhead escorted him to the safe flat, where Hawkins was waiting. Gordievsky took in his new case officer. He was tall and physically powerful, and I immediately felt ill at ease with him. Hawkins spoke formal, rather stiff German, and seemed to be eyeing his new agent in a hostile, almost threatening manner. Bromhead shook hands gravely with Gordievsky, thanked him for what he was doing, and wished him good luck. As he drove away, Bromhead felt a mixture of feelings. Regret, for he liked and admired the Russian spy, anxiety at the lingering possibility of a KGB plot, and deep relief that, for him, the case was over. "I was profoundly glad my role had ended," Bromhead wrote. "I couldn't rid myself of the thought that I might have constructed a bottomless heffalump trap into which my service was clearly determined to plunge headlong." Chapter 4. Green Ink and Microfilm. Why does anyone spy? Why give up the security of family, friends, and a regular job for the perilous twilight world of secrets? Why, in particular, would someone join one intelligence service and then switch loyalty to an opposing one? The nearest parallel to Gordievsky's secret defection from the KGB may be the case of Kim Philby, the Cambridge-educated Englishman who made the same journey but in the opposite direction, as an MI6 officer secretly working for the KGB. Like Philby, Gordievsky had undergone a profound ideological conversion, although one man was drawn to communism and the other repelled by it. But Philby's conversion occurred before he had managed to get himself recruited by MI6 in 1940, with the explicit intention of working for the KGB against the capitalist West. Gordievsky had joined the KGB as a loyal Soviet citizen, never imagining that he might one day betray it. Spies come in many shapes. Some are motivated by ideology, politics, or patriotism. A surprising number act out of avarice, for the financial rewards can be alluring. Others find themselves drawn into espionage by sex, blackmail, arrogance, revenge, disappointment, or the peculiar one-upmanship and comradeship that secrecy confers. Some are principled and brave. Some are grasping and cowardly. Pavel Sudoplatov, one of Stalin's spymasters, had this advice for his officers seeking to recruit spies in Western countries. Search for people who are hurt by fate or nature. The ugly, those suffering from an inferiority complex, craving power and influence, but defeated by unfavorable circumstances. In cooperation with us, all these find a peculiar compensation. The sense of belonging to an influential and powerful organization will give them a feeling of superiority over the handsome and prosperous people around them. For many years, the KGB used the acronym MICE to identify the four mainsprings of spying: money, ideology, coercion, and ego. But there is also romance, the opportunity to live a second, hidden life. Some spies are fantasists. Malcolm Muggeridge, former MI6 officer and journalist, wrote, "Intelligence agents, in my experience, are even bigger liars than journalists. Espionage attracts more than its share of the damaged, the lonely, and the plain weird. But all spies crave undetected influence, that secret compensation, the ruthless exercise of private power. A degree of intellectual snobbery is common to most. The secret sense of knowing important things unknown to the person standing next to you at the bus stop. In part, spying is an act of the imagination. The decision to spy on one's own country, in the interests of another, usually emerges from the collision of an outer world, often rationally conceived, and an inner world, of which the spy may be unaware. Philby defined himself as a pure ideological agent, a devoted secret soldier in the communist cause. What he did not admit was that he was also motivated by narcissism, inadequacy, his father's influence, and a compulsion to deceive those around him. Eddie Chapman, the wartime crook and double agent known as Agent Zigzag, considered himself a patriotic hero, which he was. But he was also greedy, opportunistic, and fickle, hence his codename. Oleg Penkovsky, the Russian spy who furnished the West with crucial intelligence during the Cuban Missile Crisis, hoped to prevent nuclear war. But he also wanted prostitutes and chocolates brought to his London hotel, and demanded to meet the Queen. The outer world that propelled Oleg Gordievsky into the arms of MI6 was political and ideological. He had been profoundly influenced and alienated by the building of the Berlin Wall and the crushing of the Prague Spring. He had read enough Western literature, knew enough of his nation's real history, and seen enough of democratic freedoms to know that the socialist nirvana reflected in communist propaganda was a monstrous lie. He had been brought up in a world of unquestioning obedience to a dogma. Once he had rejected that ideology, he became committed to attacking it with all the fervor of the convert. As deeply and irreversibly opposed to communism as his father, brother, and contemporaries were committed to it. A creature of the system, he understood the ruthless cruelty of the KGB firsthand. Alongside the political repression lay cultural philistinism. With the passionate fury of an aficionado, he hated ersatz Soviet music and the censorship of the Western classical canon. He demanded a different, better soundtrack to his life. But the inner world that drove Oleg is more obscure. He relished the romance and the adventure. He was undoubtedly rebelling against his father, the obedient, guilt-ridden KGB yes-man, a secretly religious grandmother, a quietly non-conformist mother, and a brother dead in the service of the KGB at the age of 39 may all have exerted a subconscious influence, driving him toward mutiny. He had little respect for most of his colleagues, KGB time servers, ignorant, lazy, and on the fiddle, who seemed to win promotion by political maneuvering and toadying. He was cleverer than most of those around him, and knew it. Gordievsky's marriage had grown cold at that time. He found it hard to make close friends. He was looking for revenge, for fulfillment, but also for love. All spies need to feel they are loved. One of the most powerful forces in espionage and intelligence work, and one of its central myths, is the emotional bond between spy and spymaster, agent and handler. Spies want to feel wanted, part of a secret community, rewarded, trusted, and cherished. Eddie Chapman established close relationships with both his British and German handlers. Philby was recruited by Arnold Deutsch, a famously charismatic KGB talent scout, whom he described as a marvelous man, who looked at you as if nothing more important in life than you and talking to you existed at that moment. Exploiting and manipulating that hunger for affection and affirmation is one of the most important skills of an agent runner. There has never been a successful spy who did not feel that the connection with his handler was something more profound than a marriage of convenience, politics, or profit. A true, enduring communion, amid the lies and deception. Gordievsky sensed several emotions radiating off Philip Hawkins, his new English case officer, but love was not among them. The eccentric and ebullient Richard Bromhead had appealed to Gordievsky by seeming terribly English. He was just the sort of bravura Englishman Lyubimov had described with such enthusiasm. Hawkins was Scottish, and colder by several degrees. Upright, clipped, as stiff and brittle as an oatcake. He felt it was his duty not to be smiley and nice, but to look at the case with a lawyerly eye, said one colleague. Hawkins had been responsible for interrogating German prisoners during the war. For several years he worked on Czech and Soviet cases, including a number of defectors. Most important, he had direct experience of handling a spy inside the KGB. Back in 1967, an Englishwoman living in Vienna contacted the British Embassy to report that she had taken in an interesting new lodger, a young Russian diplomat who seemed receptive to Western ideas and quite critical of communism. She was teaching him to ski. She was probably also sleeping with him. MI6 gave him the codename Penetrable, began to make inquiries, and discovered that the West German Intelligence Service, the BND, was also in on the chase, and had already made an approach to Penetrable, a KGB trainee, which had yielded a positive response. It was agreed to run Penetrable as a joint Anglo-West German agent. The case officer on the British side was Philip Hawkins. Philip knew the KGB backwards, said one colleague. He was paid to be skeptical. He was the obvious person to run Gordievsky. He spoke German and he was available. He was also nervous and covered his anxiety with a display of aggression. His task, as he saw it, was to find out if Oleg was lying, how much he was prepared to divulge, and what he wanted in return. Hawkins sat Gordievsky down and launched into a courtroom-style cross-examination. Who is your resident? How many KGB officers are there in the station? Gordievsky had expected to be welcomed, praised and congratulated on the momentous choice he was making. Instead, he was being hectored, interrogated as if he were a captive enemy, rather than a cooperative new recruit. The Inquisition continued for some time, and I did not like it, he said. Through Gordievsky's mind ran the thought, this can't be the true spirit of the British Intelligence Service. The grilling paused for a moment. Gordievsky raised his hand and issued a declaration. He would work for British Intelligence, but only under three conditions. First, I don't want to damage any of my colleagues in the KGB station. Second, I don't want to be secretly photographed or recorded. Third, no money. I want to work for the West out of ideological conviction, not for gain. Now it was Hawkins's turn to be affronted. Inside his mental courtroom, witnesses under cross-examination did not set rules. The second condition was moot. If MI6 decided to record him, he would never know, since the recording would, by definition, be secret. His preemptive refusal to accept financial compensation was more worrying. It is an axiom of spycraft that informants should be encouraged to accept gifts or money, although not so much that they would not want more, or would be tempted to extravagant expenditure that might attract suspicion. Cash makes a spy feel valuable, establishes the principle of payment for services rendered, and can be used, if necessary, as a lever. And why did he wish to shield his Soviet colleagues? Was he still loyal to the KGB? In reality, Gordievsky was partly protecting himself. If Denmark started ejecting KGB officers, the center might begin looking for an internal traitor, and eventually alight on him. Hawkins remonstrated. Now we know what your position in the station is. We'll think not twice but three times before we or our allies take a decision to expel anyone. But Gordievsky was adamant. He was not going to identify his fellow KGB officers, their agents and illegals, and they should be left alone. These people are not important. They are nominally agents, but they are not doing any harm. I don't want them to get into trouble. Hawkins reluctantly agreed to relay his conditions to MI6 and laid out the modus operandi. He would fly to Copenhagen once a month and stay for a long weekend, during which they could meet twice for at least 2 hours. The meetings would take place in another safe flat, provided by the Danes, though Gordievsky was not told this, in the northern suburb of Belarus, a quiet area at the end of an underground line on the other side of the city from the Soviet embassy. Gordievsky could travel by rail or car, and park some distance away. There was little chance of being spotted there by his embassy colleagues, and if Soviet surveillance was deployed in the vicinity, he would probably know about it. Danish surveillance was more of a problem. Gordievsky was a suspected KGB officer, and had been monitored by PET in the past. Loud alarm bells would ring should he be spotted going to a secret rendezvous in the suburbs. No more than half a dozen people in PET were aware that MI6 was running a Soviet agent, and only a couple of these knew his name. One of them was Jan Brunn, the head of PET counterintelligence and Bromhead's old ally. Brunn would ensure that his men were not tailing Gordievsky on the days he met his British handler. Finally, Hawkins handed over an emergency telephone number, secret ink, and a London address to which he could send any urgent messages between meetings. Both men left the flat feeling disgruntled. The first contact between spy and case officer had not been a happy one. Yet in some ways the appointment of the brusque and unsmiling Hawkins turned out well. He was a professional, and so was Gordievsky. The Russian was in the hands of someone who took his job, and Gordievsky's safety, extremely seriously. To use Bromhead's favorite phrase, Hawkins was not mucking about. So began a series of monthly meetings in a one-bedroom flat on the third floor of a nondescript apartment block in Belarus. The place was simply furnished with Danish furniture. The kitchen was fully equipped. The rent was paid jointly by the intelligence services of Britain and Denmark. A few days before the first meeting at the new OCP, two PET technicians, disguised as electricity company workers, inserted microphones in the overhead lights and electric sockets, and ran connecting wires behind the baseboards into the bedroom, where, behind a panel above the bed, they installed a tape recorder. The second of Gordievsky's conditions had been violated. The meetings were initially tense, gradually became more relaxed, and in time were exceptionally fruitful. What had started in an atmosphere of prickly suspicion would slowly evolve into a highly efficient relationship, based not on affection, but on grudging mutual respect. In lieu of love, Gordievsky accepted Hawkins's professional approval. The best way to test whether someone is lying is to ask a question to which you already know the answer. Hawkins was well-versed in the structure of the KGB. Gordievsky described, with impressive accuracy, every directorate, department, and sub-department of the sprawling, complex bureaucracy inside Moscow Center. Some of this Hawkins already knew. A great deal he did not. Names, functions, techniques, training methods, even rivalries and internal disputes, promotions and demotions. The level of detail proved that Gordievsky was straight. No dangle would have dared reveal so much. He never once asked Hawkins for information about MI6, or made any of the moves a double agent attempting to infiltrate an enemy service might make. The spymasters at MI6 headquarters were soon convinced of Gordievsky's bona fides. Sunbeam was the real thing, concluded Guscott. He was playing it fair and square. That conviction was redoubled when Gordievsky began to describe, in minute detail, the activities of Directorate S, the illegal section, where he had worked for a decade before moving to the political wing. How Moscow planted its spies, disguised as ordinary civilians all over the world, including the immense and highly sophisticated operation to create false identities, forging documents, manipulating registration records, burying moles, and the complex methodology for contacting, controlling, and financing the army of Soviet illegals. Before every meeting, Hawkins unclipped the panel in the bedroom, inserted a fresh cassette, and switched on the tape recorder. He took notes, but then carefully transcribed each recorded conversation, translating from German to English. Each hour of recording took 3 or 4 times as long to process. The resulting report was then handed to a junior MI6 officer in the British Embassy, who sent it back to London with the cassette tape in the diplomatic bag, an accepted part of international law used to pass information securely to and from embassies without interference from the host country, which was immune from search. At MI6 headquarters, the reports were eagerly awaited. British intelligence had never run a spy so deep within the KGB. As a trained intelligence officer, Gordievsky understood exactly what MI6 was looking for. At School 101, he had been taught techniques for memorizing large quantities of information. His powers of recall were prodigious. Relations between agent and case officer slowly improved. For hours they would sit on either side of a large coffee table. Gordievsky drank strong tea and occasionally asked for a beer. Hawkins drank nothing. There was little in the way of small talk. Gordievsky found it hard to like this uptight Scot with the air of an austere Presbyterian priest, but he respected him. He was not an easy man with whom to joke, but he was dedicated and hard-working, always making notes, preparing himself well and asking good questions. The British case officer frequently arrived with a shopping list of questions, which the Russian would memorize and attempt to find answers to before the next meeting. One day, Hawkins asked Gordievsky to look over one of his reports, a comprehensive write-up in German of the illegal system Oleg had described. The Russian was impressed. Clearly, Hawkins was a master of German shorthand, for not a single detail had been omitted. Only later did it strike him. MI6 must be bugging the apartment. Oleg decided not to make a fuss over the broken promise, reflecting that he would probably have done the same. I was much easier in my mind, wrote Gordievsky. My new role gave a point to my existence. That role, he believed, was nothing less than undermining the Soviet system in a Manichaean struggle between good and evil that would eventually bring democracy to Russia and allow Russians to live freely, read what they wanted, and listen to Bach. In his day job for the KGB, he continued to make Danish contacts, draw up articles for pro-Soviet journalists, and generally serviced the patchy intelligence-gathering system of the Copenhagen Residentura. The more energetic he appeared, the greater his chances of promotion and the better his access to important information. It was an odd situation, trying to demonstrate his proficiency to the KGB without actually damaging Danish interests, setting up spy operations with one hand and then unpicking them with the other by informing Hawkins of every move, keeping his eyes and ears open for useful information and gossip without seeming too inquisitive. Yelena remained wholly ignorant of what her husband was up to. A spy has to deceive even his nearest and dearest, Gordievsky later wrote. But Yelena was no longer either near or dear to him. Indeed, he felt sure that as a loyal KGB officer, she would shop him if she discovered the truth. Gordievsky knew what the KGB did to traitors. Regardless of Danish or international law, he would be seized by the operatives of the Special Actions Department, drugged, bundled onto a stretcher bound in bandages to conceal his identity, and flown to Moscow, where he would be interrogated, tortured, and then killed. The Russian euphemism for the summary death sentence was «высшая мера», highest measure. The traitor was taken into a room, made to kneel, and then shot in the back of the head. Sometimes the KGB was more imaginative. It was said that Penkovsky had been cremated alive, and his death filmed, as a warning to potential turncoats. Despite the pressure of a double life and the peril this entailed, Gordievsky was content, waging his solitary campaign against Soviet oppression. And then he fell in love. Leila Alieva was a typist for the World Health Organization in Copenhagen. The daughter of a Russian mother and a father from Azerbaijan, she was tall and striking, with a shock of dark hair and deep brown eyes behind long eyelashes. In contrast to Yelena, she was shy and unworldly. But when she relaxed, her laugh was loud and infectious. She loved to sing. Like Oleg, Leila came from KGB stock. Her father, Ali, had risen to the rank of Major General in the Azeri KGB, before retiring to Moscow. Brought up a Muslim, she had had a sheltered childhood. Her few boyfriends to date had been carefully vetted by her parents. She started work as a typist in a design firm, then worked as a journalist on the Communist Youth League newspaper, and then applied, through the Ministry of Health, for a secretarial job at the World Health Organization. Like every Soviet citizen seeking to work for a foreign organization abroad, Leila was thoroughly vetted for ideological dependability before being permitted to travel to Copenhagen. She was 28, 11 years younger than Oleg. Soon after her arrival in Denmark, Leila was invited to a reception given by the ambassador's wife, who asked her what she did in Moscow. "I was a journalist," Leila replied, "and I would like to write something about Denmark." "Then you must meet the press attaché at the embassy, Mr. Gordievsky." And so Oleg Gordievsky and Leila Alieva began working together on an article for the Communist Youth magazine about the slum district of Copenhagen. It was never published, but very swiftly their collaboration deepened. She was sociable, interesting, original, witty, and eager to be liked. I fell in love at first sight. Our love flared up quickly. Free from her parents' controlling supervision, Leila threw herself into the affair with abandon. "At his first appearance, he seemed so grey," Leila recalled. "If you saw him in the street, you would not notice him. But when I started to talk to him, my jaw dropped. He knew so much. He was so interesting, with this brilliant sense of humour. Slowly, slowly, I fell in love with him." For Gordievsky, Leila's gentle personality and simple sweetness seemed a tonic after Yelena's shrewish disdain. He had become used to calculation in his human relationships, constantly assessing his own actions and words and those of others. Leila, by contrast, was natural, outgoing, and uninhibited. Oleg felt adored, for the first time in his life. Gordievsky introduced his young lover to a new world of literature, containing ideas and realities banned in Russia. At his urging, she read Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago and The First Circle, depicting the dark brutality of Stalinism. "He gave me books from his library. I took it to my heart, this waterfall of truth. He educated me." Leila knew from the outset, without ever being told, that Gordievsky was a KGB officer. The thought that his interest in such books might conceal a deeper dissidence never crossed her mind. In whispered trysts, they made extravagant plans. They imagined having children. The KGB frowned on adultery, and even more on divorce. Our meetings were very secret. Any photo that could be evidence of adultery would be used against him and punished very severely. He would have been expelled in 24 hours. They would have to be patient. But then he was used to a slow and secret courtship. Gordievsky worked hard at both his jobs. He played a lot of badminton. Leila shared her flat with two roommates, and Yelena was often at home, so he and Leila would meet for secret assignations. Covert and thrilling. But here was another layer of deception and anxiety. He was now betraying Yelena on two levels, professional and personal. Exposure of either one could spell disaster. He covered the tracks of his double infidelity with precision and care. Every few days, He would send a disguised message to Layla and commit adultery in a different Copenhagen hotel. Every 4 weeks, he would make his way to an unremarkable flat in a boring Danish suburb and commit treason. Over the course of a year, he established a system of evasion, eluding both Soviet surveillance and the suspicions of his wife. His relationships with both Layla and MI6 were deepening. He felt safe, which he was not. One winter evening, a young Danish intelligence officer was heading home to Belarus when he spotted a car with diplomatic license plates parked in a side street, far from the diplomatic enclaves. The young man was curious. He was also trained and eager. On closer inspection, he recognized the car as belonging to the Soviet embassy. What was a Soviet diplomat doing in the suburbs at 7 p.m. on a weekend? A dusting of snow had fallen, and fresh footprints led away from the car. The pet officer followed them for about 200 yards, to an apartment block. A Danish couple was leaving as he approached, and obligingly held the front door open for him. Wet footprints crossed the marble floor to the stairs. He followed them to the door of a flat on the second floor. From inside came the sound of low voices, speaking a foreign language. He noted down the address and license plate number. The following morning, a report landed on the desk of Jørn Brun, the head of Danish counterintelligence. A Soviet diplomat, suspected of working for the KGB, had been traced to a Belarus flat, where he was overheard speaking an unidentified language, possibly German, to a person or persons unknown. "There is something suspicious here," the report concluded. "We should do something about it." But before the machinery of Danish surveillance could leap into motion, Jørn Brun switched off the engine. The report was expunged from the file. The overzealous young officer was commended for his perceptiveness and then fobbed off with a vague explanation as to why the lead was not worth pursuing. Not for the first time, a security service had, by its diligence, very nearly wrecked an ongoing case. Gordievsky was shaken to learn how close he had come to being uncovered. "The mishap gave us a shock, whose after-effects lingered," he said. Henceforth, he would travel to Belarus by underground. His refusal to name names waned as the months passed. Not that there were many names to name. The network of Soviet agents and informants in Denmark was, he revealed, pitifully small. There were Gert Petersen, the thirsty politician, an overweight policeman in the Danish immigration department who passed on occasional titbits, and several illegals planted around the country waiting for the Third World War. The KGB officers in Copenhagen, Oleg explained, spent far more time inventing contacts in order to justify their expenses than actually meeting anyone. This reassuring intelligence was passed on to Pet. The Danes were careful not to sweep up the few spies Gordievsky fingered, since this would immediately have pointed to an informant within the KGB. Instead, Pet decided to keep tabs on the handful of Danish KGB contacts and wait. If the KGB had few spies worthy of the name in Denmark, the same was not true of Denmark's Scandinavian neighbors. Gunvor Galtung Huick was an inconspicuous employee in the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, a former nurse who worked as a secretary and interpreter and was now nearing retirement. She was tiny, sweet-natured, and rather shy. She was also a veteran, highly paid spy of 30 years' standing, who had been secretly awarded the Soviet Order of Friendship for strengthening international understanding, which, in a way, she had, by handing over several thousand classified documents to the KGB. Huick's story was a classic tale of KGB manipulation. At the tail end of the war, with Norway still under Nazi occupation, she was working in a military hospital in Boda when she fell in love with a Russian prisoner of war, Vladimir Kozlov. He neglected to tell her that he was already married with a family back in Moscow. She helped him escape to Sweden. After the war, as a fluent Russian speaker, she was hired by the Norwegian Foreign Ministry and sent to Moscow as secretary to the Norwegian ambassador. There, her love affair with Kozlov was rekindled. The KGB got wind of the illicit romance and provided an apartment where they could meet. Then they threatened to expose the adulterous relationship to the Norwegians and exile Kozlov to Siberia, unless Huick agreed to spy for them. For 8 years, she passed over reams of top-secret material and continued to do so after being posted back to the Foreign Ministry in Oslo. Norway, the northern flank of NATO, shared a 120-mile Arctic border with the USSR and was regarded by the KGB as the key to the North. Here, the Cold War was fought with icy ferocity. Huyck, codenamed Greta, met 8 different KGB handlers at least 270 times. She continued to receive cash from Moscow and messages from Kozlov, or rather the KGB pretending to be her Russian lover. A gullible, heartbroken spinster, bullied into cooperating with the KGB, she was not even a communist. Anna Treholt was as conspicuous and glamorous as Huyck was not. The son of a popular Norwegian cabinet minister, a prominent journalist, and member of Norway's powerful Labour Party, he was flamboyant, handsome, and outspoken in his left-wing views. Treholt was going places, fast. He burnished his celebrity credentials by marrying a Norwegian television star, Kari Storeikre. The New York Times described him as one of the golden young men of public life in Norway. Some thought he might end up as prime minister. But in 1967, Treholt's trenchant opposition to the Vietnam War attracted the attention of the KGB. He was approached by Yevgeny Belyayev, an intelligence officer working undercover as a consular official in the Soviet embassy. Treholt later told police, a statement he subsequently recanted, that he had been recruited through sexual blackmail after an orgy in Oslo. Belyayev encouraged Treholt to accept cash in return for information, and in 1971, at the Cock Door restaurant in Helsinki, he introduced him to Gennady Fyodorovich Titov, the new KGB resident in Oslo. Titov's ruthlessness had earned him the nickname the Crocodile, although with his large round spectacles and waddling gait, he looked more like a particularly malicious owl. Titov had a reputation as the most accomplished flatterer in the First Chief Directorate. Treholt liked flattery. He also liked a free lunch. Over the next decade, he and Titov dined together at the KGB's expense on 59 occasions. "We had glorious lunches," Treholt recalled many years later, "where we discussed Norwegian and international politics." Norway lay outside Gordievsky's remit, but the Scandinavian countries were lumped together in KGB thinking, and each station was aware, to some extent, of the activities of the others. In 1974, a new KGB officer named Vadim Cherny was posted to Denmark from Moscow, where he had been working in the Scandinavian-British section of the FCD. Cherny was a mediocre officer and an inveterate gossip. One day, he let slip that the KGB was running a woman agent, codenamed Greta, inside Norway's diplomatic service. A few weeks later, he mentioned that the KGB had recruited another, even more important agent inside the Norwegian government, someone with a journalistic background. Gordievsky passed this information on to Hawkins, who reported it back to MI6 and PET. These two highly valuable leads were conveyed to Norwegian counterintelligence. The source was heavily camouflaged. Norway was told the report was reliable, but not who or where it came from. This was not information Oleg was supposed to have in the course of his work, but stuff he had picked up, so we decided it could not be traced back directly to him. The Norwegians were grateful and thoroughly alarmed. Gunvor Hoik, the demure senior secretary at the Foreign Ministry, had been under suspicion for some time. Gordievsky's warning provided crucial confirmation. Fashionable young Anna Treholt had also popped up on the radar after being spotted in the company of a known KGB operative. Both would now be closely watched. The Norwegian connection illustrated a central challenge of the Gordievsky case and a conundrum of spying in general. How to make use of high-grade intelligence without compromising its source. An agent deep inside the enemy camp may unmask spies in your own camp, but if you arrest and neutralize them all, then you alert the other side to the spy within their own camp, and you endanger your source. How could British intelligence take advantage of what Gordievsky was revealing without burning him? From the start, MI6 opted to play the long game. Gordievsky was still a young man. The information he supplied was excellent, and it would only improve with time and promotion. Too much haste or hunger for information might scupper the case and destroy Gordievsky. Security was paramount. The Philby disaster had taught Britain the perils of betrayal